From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In her recent book, Late Migrations, and also in big letters displayed across the homepage of her website, New York Times contributing opinion columnist Margaret Renkel reminds herself and her readers where to focus their attention. Every day the world is teaching me what I need to know to be in the world, she writes. We'll talk to Renkel, gardener, lifelong student of nature and writer, in just a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Margaret Renkel lives and gardens in Nashville, Tennessee. Each Monday, her opinion column appears in the New York Times, billed under the loose rubric Flora, Fauna, Politics, and Culture in the American South, and covering topics as diverse as hummingbird migration and the recent dire assessment of bird population decline, to capital punishment, and even country music. Since reading it not long ago, I couldn't wait to tell all you listeners about her book, Late Migrations, A Natural History of Love and Loss. And I'm grateful that Margaret made time to join us today to help in that telling. Thank you so much and welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Oh, well, I love the book very much. I suppose that's not doesn't sound very subjective or whatever to say that, but boy, it's a wonderful book, and we'll talk about it. But before we get to the book proper, since we're among an audience of gardeners, I wanted everyone to meet Margaret Renkel, the gardener, kind of in her natural habitat. And your Monday columns in the Times, I wanted to read just a tiny snippet from one around this time last year, where you said, I've never been a very orderly gardener. In spring, I prefer planting to weeding. I like to watch birds pulling seeds from dried flowers, so I let the flowers fall to ruin in summer instead of deadheading them to force the plants to produce new blooms. So what's the view out the window right there, and what kind of gardener are you?
I actually think gardener might be a little bit of a stretch.
Okay.
My garden consists of two kinds of weeds, the kind I cultivate and the kind I pull out. I plant really more for the sake of wildlife than for the sake of the human eye.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what a person plants when trying to cultivate bees and butterflies and other pollinators are what other gardeners might call weeds. I mean, there are so many of these weeds, these flowers actually have weed in their name. I'm looking at
yes.
a pokeweed plant right now that
yes.
is bearing very deep purple berries that the mockingbirds love so much that they fight with each other continually to hoard the pokeweed berries for themselves. I'm also looking at the remnants of all the milkweed that I planted a few years ago, and that generally, not 100% of the time, but generally drops seeds and returns in the spring. So
mm-hmm.
some of those flowers that I've planted are actual weeds. But I also have we haven't had a hard freeze yet. We've had a couple of light frosts. So I still have blooming zinnias. I still have blooming Cleome. I have daisies that are in their third round of blooming. I have some Giardia
mm-hmm.
That's blooming for the second time. So I think we're going to get a freeze tonight.
Uh-oh.
But but I actually let the garden go completely.
Yeah.
Once it's bloomed out, I know that there are pollinators who leave chrysalises and cocoons on the dried stems, and there are bumblebees that bury in the soil that I don't want to risk dislodging by doing a lot of weeding at this stage or a lot of cutting back. So my garden stays a skeleton.
Yeah.
It's prior life all through the winter.
I'm inferring from your description, which, by the way, I believe in, especially a little bit of a messier approach to fall cleanup to invite and accommodate those creatures, those such important creatures as you're speaking about, or spiders, for instance, all these overwintering
right.
beneficials, right? I think
right.
you're absolutely right about that. I mean, two Margarets think alike, north and south. But I infer maybe from your description that it doesn't look like the other yards on the block exactly, maybe? Does it look like everyone else's front yard or backyard?
It doesn't look anything like anybody else's yard. My neighborhood, like much of Nashville, is undergoing a really rapid and almost shocking to me kind of gentrification. Mm-hmm. So this neighborhood was initially a very working class neighborhood. It was built between 1945 and 1950. All the houses were built between 1945 and 1950 for soldiers returning to the U.S. after World War II and buying their first homes on the GI Bill. So they all had two bedrooms or maybe three bedrooms, very small little ranch houses that are now being scraped from the lot, and large grand homes are going up in their places. And one of the things that happens when an area becomes more affluent is that often the people in those houses are working very demanding professional jobs, and they don't do their own yard work. I mean, there's almost no one here left
yes.
who does
yes.
their own yard work, and they hire lawn services, and even without, I think, knowing what the lawn services are necessarily doing, there's a lot of spraying for a lot of herbicides, a lot of insecticides that are designed to create an emerald lawn, whereas my lawn is made up almost exclusively of clover and wildflowers that we mow down after they bloom. But to look sort of like a yard.
Yeah.
But it's very different.
Yeah. So the book, it's called Late Migrations, as I said earlier, A Natural History of Love and Loss. And I wonder if you would introduce listeners to it who might not have read it, sort of the what's the book about jacket flap version of the intention of the book.
It's still so hard for me to do that. I haven't quite found the perfect elevator pitch for this book. I didn't understand that I was writing a book until well into the process. I thought I was writing a set of essays that were a response to my grief about the loss of my mother, her sudden death, and also the death after a very long bout with 18 years of Parkinson's disease that my mother-in-law endured. And I started writing the essays about a month before my mother-in-law died. And they just were very short. I had very little time to do my own writing. I had a full-time editing job. I had children still at home and my grieving father-in-law to care for. And so I was just writing in little drips and drabs to try to crystallize my thoughts and my feelings about this tumultuous time we were undergoing. And at the same time I was spending more time looking out the window at the natural world of my backyard, in part in response to the changes my neighborhood was undergoing, but in part because I found that that focus helped me with the grief. It helped me see that life and death are just, that cycle is very natural and nothing to fight or to fear. My mother was 80 when she died. My mother-in-law was 81. These were not tragic or untimely deaths. It was part of the natural order of things, and it helped me. It was a great comfort to me.
Yeah.
And so after I had done a little pile of both kinds of essays, I started to see that really they were connected in fundamental ways. The creatures in my backyard felt like family, and what was happening to the natural world, both in my own neighborhood and in and to the planet in the form of climate change was a source of great grief to me.
Yeah.
So I began experimenting with ways to combine them, and what ultimately resulted was late migration.
Yeah. Well, it's a little eerie for me, really, the book. We're both Margarets, actually, both M.R., Renkel mm-hmm. and Roach. We're both blessed with learning from some strong, important women in our lives. In my case, my grandmother handed down to me a lot of her wisdoms and her gardening passion and so forth. We both garden, albeit a little messily here and there. I started my career at the New York Times. You're working there now at this part of your life. I could go on citing moments in the book where I squealed or nearly cried at sort of intense recognition, even though I don't know you. You've done something with this book that I admire and I'm jealous of and love, which is its unusual structure that you just were referring to. And I think of like the author Abigail Thomas, for instance, who writes about very, very different material, but in a fragmentary little bits, little essays, yet they're so connected, as you've accomplished with Late Migrations. And
I do. I love her work.
I bet you do. See, I knew. I just knew that. I knew that you would, and me too. So the sentence I quoted up top where you say on your website and in the book, every day the world is teaching me what I need to know to be in the world, reminds me of some favorite lines from 100 years ago, New York State naturalist, someone who lived across the river from where I live now, John Burroughs, and he said, to learn something new, take the path that you took yesterday. And he also said, look underfoot, you're always nearer to the true sources of your power than you think. So I think of you as echoing those types of statements. And you said, you know, looking out the window, you found help with the grief, but also that it's all part of a cycle. Are there some sort of plants or moments or things that you grasp? I think you have 9 bird feeders hanging outside. Were there teachers, were there particular characters who again and again, who come in the book, who did some of the teaching and the helping along the way in particular?
Well, you mentioned your grandmother, and
yeah.
Of course my grandmother, it figures prominently in the book. She actually speaks in several of the essays. We have a treasure trove as a family of her words, because my brother years ago spent some time interviewing her, and after our mother died, he found the tapes, the cassette tapes, and transcribed them, and created a printout of a little book just for our family about of those interviews. And I found myself going back and back and back to that book that to verify facts or to check my dates.
Mm.
And one day I just realized I should just let my grandmother tell these little stories.
Yes.
Because her voice was so important to me growing up. She was very much, even though my great-grandmother lived until I was in college, my grandmother was such a source of strength and power in our family. My mother struggled in my early childhood with debilitating depression, and my brother and I, this was before our sister was born, were often left with our grandparents. My grandfather had had 2 terrible heart attacks just before my parents married and was largely an invalid. And, of course, my great-grandmother lived in the house with them as well, and she was helpful, but very, very quiet. She was just a quiet person. So my grandmother's voice is the voice I hear when I think of
yes.
the matriarchy of the that really raised me.
Yeah.
And I was so grateful to have had access to those interviews, because it allowed me to start the book in her voice with the birth of my mother.
Yes.
And to end the book when we were burying our parents' ashes, my brother and sister and I.
Mm. I think you say in the book, and so there, the book, there's, it's obviously quite poignant, and there's sadness, but there's also acceptance, and you see beauty and joy and the life force happening too. You know, it's not just dark at all. And
My mother was very, very funny. My
yeah.
mother was hilarious.
Yeah.
And so candid. And I tried to convey some humor through the story too, because I don't think even a book that's so focused on natural cycles, which include death, can leave out joy, because those things are companions.
Yeah.
Those feelings are companion feelings.
There's one little essay in it, In Praise of the Unlovely World, that I especially remember and love. And I won't ask you to read it, because you probably don't even have the book in front of you. I don't want to spring it on you, but I just wanted to read like two sentences of it, and where you say, teetering between despair and terror, alarmed by the perils that threaten the planet, defeated in imagining any real way to help, I'm tempted to turn away, to focus on what is lovely in a broken world, moonlight on still water, the full body embrace of bumblebees and the milkweed flowers, the first dance of the newlyweds whose eyes never leave each other in all their turnings on the gleaming floor. So even with all the heaviness, you see past it and you see these glimmers, these hopeful glimmers. And I think that was again and again in the book what really spoke to me, because I find such solace. People ask me, what am I doing? Because I live alone in a rural place, of town of 300, and, you know, and they say, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking out the window. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
That's where I get informed all day long, is by looking out the window. And I felt like you also find great inspiration and solace in that.
There's a line in, I think it's in Walden, but it might just be in Henry David Thoreau's journals, and I know I'm not quoting exactly, but he says, I have, or something like, I have traveled extensively in Concord. And I've always loved that line, because it's exactly what I think is true. I mean, I'm not in any way knocking grand traveling as a way of understanding the world, but I think there's an equal way of understanding the world by knowing very well your own little place in the world.
Mm. Do you have a daily practice, so to speak? Do you have something that you do every day? Are you a walker, a hiker? Is there some exploration or exercise or practice that you have that you engage with nature, or is it just part of, you know, all of every day?
Well, I have two workspaces in the house now that my children are mostly grown.
Mm-hmm.
The table at the end of our family room, the wall of windows at the end of our family room, used to be the table where they all their art supplies were when they were very small, and then later where their school computers and printer and all were. I've taken over that whole space now, and it looks out on the pollinator garden and also on the bird feeding station that's focused on peanuts and suet. But on the other side of the house is my actual little office. It looks out on a bluebird house and a whole bunch of trees and woody shrubs that produce berries that I planted based on the timing when they produce fruit
mm-hmm.
to feed the migratory birds. I'm looking right now at a red-tailed hawk sitting in a pine tree. On the other side of the house earlier today, I saw a magnolia warbler, which I've never seen in this yard.
Oh, nice.
And so for me, working and looking out, those are inseparable activities because there's just so much to see. But I do try at least 3 or 4 days a week to go out to the woods somehow. We're blessed in Nashville with a number of beautiful parks. There's a national wildlife refuge right in Nashville. There's an extensive greenway system. There's a city park, a wild wilderness, basically, that's, I think, maybe the second or third largest protected area in an urban setting in the country.
Oh.
So there's a lot of walking trails very close to my house, and I have always, especially writing this book, I've gone almost every day. Things are a little different now. I'm only just coming off book tour, and
yes.
I I sort of feel like surviving book tour was my only goal. I didn't have
you lowered the bar.
I lowered the bar to the point of zero practice.
I know. I understand. I just had a book come out in the spring, and I feel like it just tried to wring the life out of me running around like that. Yeah.
It's very heartening to talk with people who have read a book that, you know what it is, you're writing this book entirely in solitude.
Yes.
And then suddenly there are people who have read it and who have their own stories to share about a grandmother or a mother or a yard, a garden. And it's very gratifying. It's heart-lifting, really. But the travel is very difficult for me.
Me
too. Because I am one of those that just wants to stay in Concord.
Yeah, me too. And walk pace over the same pathways and the same terrain all the time over and again and always see something new. Yes, absolutely. one of the other voices, and I put that maybe in quotes, voices, in your book is your brother's, because he created these, I think they're collages, I'm not entirely sure. He's an artist.
That's correct, yeah. Collages.
To open kind of every section or thereabouts. And that must have been very intimate, too, the fact that he would be there expressing it along with you, interpreting, reacting, responding, and interpreting from what you wrote. Have you worked together before like that? They're wonderful. His work is wonderful.
My brother is only a year younger than I am,
uh-huh.
And so I don't have any memory of life before him.
Yeah.
And we were possibly the last generation of children to be raised. We were essentially feral. We were, you know, as long as we were together, we could go anywhere we wanted to go.
Right.
We left when we were dressed in the morning, and we came home when we were hungry.
Yeah.
And we spent almost our entire childhood outdoors. As we got older, so his aesthetic is incredibly similar to mine anyway. His work, if you look at the work that has nothing to do with late migrations on his website, you can see that his gallery work is so often concerned with stars and trees and flowers and birds and grasses, and he often begins a body of work in a text of some kind that he's responding to. So that alone was reason enough to think about how to integrate his work into late migrations.
Mm.
But we also have a long history because we shared the same group of friends in high school,
sure,
and in college and grad school, of working together on school projects. When we were very young, we made little booklets for our parents and grandparents for presents, and later we worked together on student publications. I was the editor of the school newspaper, and he was the art director.
Oh, how funny!
I was the editor of the college magazine. He was the art director of the college magazine, and you know, it right up through graduate school.
Oh, okay. I'm glad
so
I asked.
We went to the same high school, the same college, and the same graduate school.
Wow.
Only a year apart each time. And but as far as this particular book, I'm so glad for the way you described it, because I do think of it as a kind of dialogue.
Yes.
Rather than that I wrote something that he illustrated. I tried to encourage him to put aside anything that he thought I might want and just respond to the words.
Yeah. Well, with the transcript of this conversation that we've been having, we just have a minute left, but we'll have a book giveaway, but I'll also show a couple of examples of the work that we're talking about so that people can visualize it. And also a link to his website as well, Billy Rankel, correct? Is that right? Did I say
that's
that?
That's right,
yeah.
BillyRankel.com.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And but I'm so glad to talk to you, and I'm as I said, I just enjoyed the book so much, and I know my listeners and readers are kindred spirits, and I think that they're going to really enjoy it too. And I hope they're readers of your New York Times weekly columns, which I always look forward to. So I'm your fangirl, Margaret Rankle.
And I am yours, Margaret Rankle. Thank you so much.
Good. Well, thank you so much again for making time, and I'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.